From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. In April of this year, a lawsuit was quietly filed in federal court. The 200-page complaint names various officials at state agencies and local governments. It claims they knowingly aided and abetted the physical or sexual assault of children while in juvenile detention and correctional facilities in Nevada. The suit brought by John Doe lists 96 accounts of sexual assault of minors by correctional staff over the span of decades and paints a picture in vivid and excruciating detail. It also alleges that the abuse was, quote, not a matter of isolated misconduct, but rather systemic failure. Those allegations come just months after state inspectors published their own report. It questioned whether management at some facilities, or even those who license them, are adequately protecting the children in their care. Here now to talk about that is Tabitha Mueller. She's the Nevada Independent reporter who broke the story. Tabitha, thanks for taking the time to talk to me.
Thanks for having me on.
Roughly 100 people are accusing various officials at state and county levels of physical and sexual abuse. Give me the broad strokes. What is this lawsuit alleging?
So I'm going to put a caveat here that this lawsuit, I mean, reading it is horrendous. It's an excruciating detail. It's sickening. And that, I mean, I've heard that word so many times talking about this, but I think that sort of a broad overview, I'd say that it describes molestation, rape, masturbation, penetration of minors in juvenile correction facilities at the hands of officials who are supposed to be taking care of them, or what the allegations say.
Where was this abuse happening, and what's the time frame of it? Are some of the victims currently in state or local custody?
Most of these victims are largely adults now, right? But when this happened, many of them were 11 or 12. I mean, the abuse sort of took place from the alleged abuse took place from 2001 to about 2024, right? And it sort of claims that facility staff actively worked to conceal it within those years. And as part of that, in that time frame, I mean, we're talking about, when we're saying conceal, like bribery, threats of more sexual harassment, more sexual assaults, that kind of thing. So really, just horrifying allegations to read.
Sounds incredibly vile. Just reading the story you published was excruciating. Was this more of a Clark County issue, or is this something that's happened statewide, the rurals? Where?
It definitely focuses on the state. There are officials in the state who are named. It also alleges that it took place in Clark County facilities as well as Douglas County facilities. And what's interesting about a suit like this, I mean, we're talking 96 people. As the suit gets more attention, it's likely that there could be more folks who join on if they had similar experiences. Time will tell on that one.
You know, how have those accused agencies responded? Have you heard back from them at all?
So we reached out to different agencies, and they all said they couldn't comment on pending litigation, right? So this is ongoing through the court system. And it's sort of a matter, again, of time will tell.
You know, before the suit was filed, state inspectors in December, I believe, published a report finding welfare and safety concerns in about a third of the children's facilities that they reviewed. What does that report say?
So what that report is basically saying is that there are things that made inspectors question, you know, the safety of children in these homes, right? Sort of interesting about reports like that is it's not saying that the problems are fixed. It's just more pointing out that, hey, there are problems and concerns. And when we're talking about some of those concerns, they listed out the names of different facilities, and they said, look, that report did focus on sort of more egregious instances, right? But there were things like loaded firearms in foster care homes that were not attended, that were not put away, that children could have had access to, right? So real safety concerns, but then also concerns about people not being able to report instances of abuse or issues like that, right? And what I think is the thing that I sort of pulled away from is that report was really focused on the foster care system, whereas what we were talking about with this lawsuit is the juvenile justice system. But both of them are underneath the care and supervision of the state and county officials, right? And that's what folks are sort of talking about is there enough protections for minors in these situations?
Ultimately, what are victims hoping to come out of this lawsuit?
So the lawsuit that was filed, victims are asking for compensation ranging from mental health, helping them address their mental health needs, as well as damages as in a lot of different forms, right? And I think they're also looking for accountability here. I mean, these are victims who had a lot of, you know, their youth taken away in a large respect from what they're alleging. And they're asking for, hey, this is not okay. And we want compensation for that and restitution.
That's Tabitha Mueller, a Nevada Independent reporter, talking to me about a recent pair of stories she wrote. They cover allegations of abuse across Nevada's juvenile justice system. Tabitha, thank you for this reporting.
Thanks for having me on.
Roughly 5,000 Nevada children were in county or state custody during fiscal year 2023. What could the lawsuit mean for them and the state? And what's needed to prevent this from happening again? Attar Hasibula is the executive director of the ACLU of Nevada. Attar, welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. As you mentioned there from Tabitha, these victims are looking for a certain measure of accountability. Let me ask you, this is a civil suit. Why not get law enforcement involved? Why isn't the DA involved in something like this?
You know, part of the issue overall with these types of issues when they come forward where government is on the other end of a civil claim, oftentimes that's a result of inadequate processes that have occurred along the way. And more often than not, that is government committing or government employees or officials committing an act of wrongdoing, there being internal investigations and or nothing happening and nothing coming from them. Civil lawsuits oftentimes are the only recourse that victims of abuse by the government in any form or fashion have to be able to maintain any level of recourse. Independent investigations over the course of time seem optically beneficial for the government. But at the end of the day, very few people believe that the outcomes of those investigations actually yield adequate outcomes to protect survivors of sexual violence or other people harmed in other types of civil rights abuses that occur.
What exactly is the state's legal obligation to provide care for children in its custody?
Well, there's a variety of legal standards that apply to ensure that juveniles or children who are in detention facilities and anyone within state care is actually treated adequately. Under our existing constitutional precedents federally, there remains a variety of provisions that are incumbent on state facilities to ensure the protection of those within its care. That includes a requirement to adequately train and supervise staff. It also ensures and requires that in certain instances, including with respect to young people in juvenile detention facilities, that there's a zero tolerance policy that ends up associated with acts of sexual violence, as has been promulgated previously at the federal level. The issue that has arisen out of this a specific scenario is we have two decades worth of claims related to sexual assault by employees of the state or of local governments who have in fact engaged in really horrendous conduct. There was no follow-up there that seems to have been conducted, at least within the lawsuit as it's been specified and within other reports that have existed over time. And as a result, there's been immense harm that's come forward. 96 plaintiffs is quite a lot of plaintiffs, and two decades worth of aggravated conduct, including threats to those who said that they would come forward and report those individuals who were involved for the egregious conduct in which they engaged, really kind of prevented and chilled their ability to do so because there was no safety guaranteed for those individuals if they would have reported, for those young people, if they would have reported those same sexual abusers to their supervisors. And so overall, it seems like it was woeful misconduct on the state's end. And the only recourse that really does exist is for this lawsuit to move forward and policymakers potentially to look at this again and see what safeguards they can put in place to protect these kids.
Unfortunately, Attar, this is not an isolated incident. Los Angeles County is in the midst of figuring out how to pay $4 billion to victims of abuse there. What kind of legal liability does this sort of thing put on the state and taxpayers?
Immense potential liability exists as a result of local and state government misconduct on a frequent basis. And this specific case actually highlights some of the most egregious forms of misconduct. Again, we're talking about two decades worth of sexual abuse claims, and the claims are laid out in great detail. They crossed gender lines. There was both female and male victims. seeing that the bulk of the age ranges for those who were victimized were 13, 14, and 15, 96 different plaintiffs. And there were statements that were within the claims that the plaintiffs put forward that alleged there were witnesses to the incidents in many of these instances that occurred. And when the young people said that they would go forward because of the horrendous abuse they faced, they were threatened with even more sexual violence. That's a pervasive problem that exists. And the nature of the way detention is handled overall in this state, where we continue to incarcerate people at scale, and the vilification that occurs within many of the news cycles surrounding the incarceration process actually leaves a lot of these stories in the dark. The sympathy that's associated with many instances of victimization don't occur when we're talking about detainees. And in this instance, what we're seeing is really egregious abuse that's been pervasively ignored by the state. Nothing's been done. And we're hoping, at least on the ACLU's end, that justice is brought forward through this civil suit and the state actually engages in corrective behavior. It's impossible for them to make up for the misconduct that they've engaged in, but they certainly, at least awareness has been brought to the conversation surrounding the issues that have existed here.
Attar Hazipula is the executive director of the ACLU of Nevada. Attar, thank you.
Thanks so much.
A couple of bombshells landed on the gaming industry in the past month. First, Caesars Entertainment said it would be bought by billionaire Tilman Fertitta for $17.6 billion per shareholder and regulatory approvals. Fertitta owns three Golden Nugget properties in Nevada. Then People Incorporated made an $18 billion offer to buy MGM Resorts. People is a publishing company headed by businessman Barry Diller, and it's already MGM's largest shareholder. MGM's board of directors, which includes Diller, is reviewing the deal. Gaming companies and casinos get bought and sold all the time. However, these two purchases involve the two biggest operators in the state, where just on the Strip, they have 23 total properties. How might this affect Las Vegas tourism and operations of all of those destinations? David McKee is a longtime gaming reporter with a column at the Las Vegas Advisor. He's also an editor at Casino Life. David, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you, Paul.
For many Nevada residents, news of the potential sale of these giants may come as a bit of a surprise. You know, were there signs of these sales coming?
Anytime you hear gaming executives talking about how their stock is not valued as highly as it should be, it's a sign that they're shopping for a buyout.
So no surprise there. Then let's talk about the Caesars Entertainment offer first. It's for almost $18 billion and includes Caesar's debt load of nearly $12 billion. You recently wrote that debt servicing was one of two Achilles' heels for the economic performance of the Strip. That could worsen should both of these deals go through. How so?
Well, the debt burden is going to... The Caesars purchase, two-thirds of that price of $17.6 billion, is going to be debt. The company already pays $2.3 billion a year to pay down the interest on that debt. There's been little sign of that debt being retired. Some of it dates back to 2008 when Gary Loveman took Caesars private in a disastrous leveraged buyout. So that debt is theoretically old enough to vote as we speak. It's a situation where Caesars is going to be, they're going to take an already onerous debt burden and compound it even further. So it's a huge wager that the Las Vegas economy is not only going to stay good, but it's going to improve, because it has to in order for this deal to succeed.
Fertitta currently owns 12.6 million of shares of Wynn Resorts. Is that a conflict of interest between those shares and his potential ownership of Caesars? And would that need to be addressed before any of this could be resolved?
I don't expect it to be addressed, because Nevada has such a lax gambling regulatory system. But broadly, it's a conflict Narrowly, not so much, because Wynn is strictly high-end focus. Caesars is kind of weak on the high end. They're a middle market, low-end sort of company. So, if anything, I think what this puts in play down the road is Fertitta trying to roll the two companies together so that he has one gargantuan casino company that's strong in the low, middle, and high end.
Speaking of that lower end casino chain, the Golden Nugget, has he done a good job operating that?
It really depends on who you ask. Unfortunately, the casinos are privately held, so we in the media don't get a lot of transparency into what's going on there. They have a reputation of being overpriced, of squeezing the video poker pay tables for one thing. When Fertitta was still in the publicly held sphere, and a Fertitta insider told me some very unflattering things about the operating model of Tillman's restaurants, and it wouldn't surprise me if the same philosophy bo held over to his casinos. Their performance varies greatly. The Golden Nugget in Atlantic City is circling the drain. The Golden Nugget in Lake Charles, Louisiana is doing very well. It's very difficult to generalize about the Golden Nugget casino chain.
Let's move on to the MGM deal. People Inc. is not a gaming or hospitality company. What impact could that have on them joining the hospitality industry?
Well, it depends on how much understanding they have of the hospitality industry, which it sounds like they don't have a lot at present. So, are they going to trust Bill Hornbuckle and his brain trust at MGM? Or are they going to second guess how they're operating primarily on the Strip, but also elsewhere in the country? And there are already signs that they're second guessing what MGM is doing internationally. So, I think the jury is very much out on this one as opposed to Caesars, whereas Fertitta in that case is well seasoned in the casino realm. As you said, Diller's company is not, his SPAC is not gaming experience. So this is going to be a very interesting situation if it plays out.
These company mergers usually come with consolidation or review of expenses, bottom line, usually employee layoffs. Is there any concern of that at this point?
I haven't heard anything about employee layoffs. In order to merge Caesars and the Golden Nugget, what you would probably see is some decimation at the middle management and upper management levels. He'll still need people to run the physical casinos. But MGM, I don't know. They could try to justify the expense of the buyout by decimating employees. As far as you could definitely see an upward pressure on sales at both so upward pressure on sales on prices at both companies as they try to make their nut on these heavily leveraged buyouts.
David, we got about 10 seconds left. Is this a good move for the gaming industry or a bad move?
Very bad unless the economy rebounds incredibly.
David McKee is a longtime gaming reporter with a column at the Las Vegas Advisor. He's also an editor of Casino Life. David, thanks again.
Thank you.
As a note, MGM, Caesars, and Wynn are all financial supporters of Nevada Public Radio. So, how do casino mergers affect the casinos and their patrons? KNPR's Mike Pravat put the question to gaming historian and UNLV professor David Schwartz earlier this week. Here's that conversation.
David, welcome back to State of Nevada.
Yeah, glad to be back.
Hey, we're glad to have you here. I want to go back to the year 2000 for a minute. That's when the company known as MGM Grand Inc. bought Mirage Resorts and then became MGM Mirage. And then 5 years later, MGM Mirage bought Mandalay Resort Group, and this gave MGM ownership of virtually all the properties on the west side of the Strip between Russell and Spring Mountain. And then they also owned MGM Grand and Circus Circus as well. I'm wondering if all of that changing of hands affected the casinos in any considerable way.
Yeah, it definitely caused a lot of consolidation and was part of a bigger trend in Vegas towards fewer companies owning more.
And I'll ask the same question about Caesars Entertainment, whose own evolution in the last 30 years has been marked by either them buying gaming entities or being bought by them and spinning off companies and so forth. And just to take a specific property, something as iconic as Caesar's Palace, can major changes to a property like that be attributable to the changing of ownership of its parent company? Or do properties mostly change and grow because of external things like economic forces or customer demand?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. But when you have one company owning multiple properties, they can slot the properties at different parts of the market. So that will affect how they position them.
And do you feel that, you know, all of these corporate changes that have happened in Vegas have signaled a major shift in operations from the way that casinos were operated 40, maybe 50 years ago?
Well, there's definitely been a shift in that time, you know, and mostly it's because of, like you said, who is owning them. And when they were owned by the small groups, you know, basically they just had to satisfy them. But once you're publicly traded, you now have lots of people who want to see growth every quarter. So that's going to impact how they run.
Now, I want to talk about the people that patronize these casinos. You know, just as an example, I remember my parents were once loyal customers of the Luxor. But when MGM laid off their casino host after that 2005 merger, you know, they were pretty angry and they defected to the Caesars property that ultimately picked up that casino host. And before that even happened, you know, I'd hear them grumble about changes that MGM had already made at Luxor. Are patron attitudes like this sort of part and parcel of ownership change on the Strip, or I guess maybe put another way, is the impact of those buyouts significant on the patron?
I think so, because nobody's going to buy a property to keep it the same. So there's going to be changes once that happens. That could be personnel, as happened in that case. It could be something as simple as where they're getting their toiletries from. You know, it could be a whole range of things.
Do you feel that the hospitality aspect of these properties gets lost in the shuffle when these companies are now starting to focus on, as you said earlier, consolidation and the streamlining of operations, you know, despite the fact that this is a major hospitality mecca in the country?
Yeah, it definitely changes the nature of what the properties are. You know, when you have people who are responsible for one, they're going to have a different level of care than when they're responsible for many. And again, it could just affect how they're positioning them within Vegas itself.
Now, People Incorporated, this is the company that's trying to buy MGM Resorts. They're not a gaming or hospitality company. They're largely a publishing company. And I'm wondering if there were previous instances where a company that was also not in gaming or hospitality bought and operated a Vegas casino, and that property remained successful.
Everybody's got to start somewhere. When Caesar's Palace changed hands the first time, it was bought by Lums, who were famous for hot dogs soaked in beer, cooked in beer, and later they became Caesar's World after they acquired Caesar's. So everybody's to start somewhere.
David, as a historian, are these recent buyout offers just kind of old hat at this point? Maybe another case of, well, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
I think it's a lot about the evolution, and we went through the period first where you had more independent owner-operators, then we had more consolidation, publicly traded companies, and now we may be evolving to the next stage. You know, also the real estate investment trusts owning many of the properties themselves adds another layer to all this.
And that's David Schwartz. He is a gaming historian and UNLV professor. David, thanks again for your time.
Thanks for having me.
For 63 years, the historic Commercial Center has stood in the heart of Las Vegas. Back then, it was the place to go for shopping, dining, and entertainment for those who didn't want to deal with the Strip. Since then, it's experienced more than its fair share of ebbs and flows. Promises of revitalization have given way to threats of partial demolition, which in turn become new promises of redevelopment. And yet, despite that downward trajectory since the 70s, some have remained committed to the area, its history, and its future potential. KNPR's Rafaela Gandolfo Bustamante brings us more.
Less than a mile from the bustle of the Las Vegas Strip is the historic Commercial Center District. And despite a rush of cars passing by, the roughly 18-acre parking lot is nearly empty. Of course, it didn't used to be this way.
It was just a lively community every weekend for sure.
That's Penny Chitima, manager of Lotus of Siam, one of the 150 businesses listed on the Commercial Center's website.
You had someone that was having their quinceañera, or somebody was having like a debut or Korean karaoke here and there.
The mall opened in 1963 and almost immediately became a landmark of commerce and culture. It's where Elvis shopped, Rat Pack members dined, The Doors and Bob Marley performed, and mobsters schemed. Chitima's mother opened Lotus of Siam in the Commercial Center back in 1999. Its Northern Thai cuisine has received recognition from the likes of American chef Anthony Bourdain and Pulitzer Prize-winning critic Jonathan Gold. It's drawn large crowds to the strip mall over the years. Despite that success, Chitima says, the place has seen better days.
It was really this hole in the wall, and around it is kind of scary.
Since the district's heyday in the 70s, multi-million dollar investments have sprung up across the Las Vegas Valley, spurring competition to modernize and expand. At the same time, crime rates around the center have steadily increased. Still, that hasn't dashed the hopes of reversing the district's downhill trajectory. In 2003, Clark County designated the Commercial District as its first redevelopment area. The county then bought the center's historic New Orleans Square in 2024. Last year, the county's redevelopment agency paid a consulting firm to create plans for a so-called Commercial Center 2.0, which included new arts and dining venues, festivals, and residential development. None of that has come to fruition, and debate over expensive redevelopment or cheaper demolition continues. However, some say those revitalization efforts could lead to the loss of the area's culture and community. That includes Clark County Commissioner Tick Segerbloom.
Vegas has always been, let's look forward. If it's 10 years old, it's old. We're going to tear it down and build something new.
Segerbloom says the area is perfectly suited as a central location, somewhere diverse communities can continue to prosper in the heart of the city. It's that centrality that sold Derek Stonebarger on the area. He already owns Popular Rebar in the Arts District and is now planning to open Artie's Steakhouse in the Commercial Center. It'll also double as an art gallery for local vendors. He sees its potential as a major hub.
Sahara and Las Vegas Boulevard is pretty much the dead center of our town. There's just so much opportunity based on our location.
The intersection sees roughly 70,000 cars daily, according to the city of Las Vegas. In addition, a new $373 million bus line will run along nearby Maryland Parkway starting in August. Stonebarger's hope is clear. After pouring what he says is more than his life savings into the project, he says his goal for the place is to be community-based, where visitors can thrive in relics of prior eras.
It's really a melting pot for our city, and that's going to continue. And it's really hopefully going to be based all around art, culture, and community.
Longtime residents of the area are also holding their ground, like John Fish. He co-owns John Fish Jewelers, which has resided in the Commercial Center for 50 years. He recognizes what the center can offer demographically diverse communities.
It feels like we're going through a big change period for the better. The big businesses, of course, they have their place, but you just don't feel like you're like a person, you feel more like a number.
Still, safety concerns are persistent. Just 5 years ago, the area was considered one of the most dangerous in Las Vegas. Clark County has since worked with the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department to increase security. Segerbloom says that should help attract new businesses and customers.
With that, have people revitalize the existing apartments there. There's lots of things come when people feel secure.
That sense of safety, combined with new investment, has begun to shift perceptions of the area's future for Stonebarger, Fish, and Segerbloom. Additionally, the newly renovated Lotus of Siam has recently reopened its original Commercial Center location. That's after pandemic-related staffing shortages forced its closure. Manager Penny Chitima is hopeful that their homecoming can bring more traffic and culture back to the plaza.
I feel like Commercial Center always has that special place. I'm hoping, knock on wood, that, you know, people will see the true beauty of what it is. Kind of like lotus flower, right? It grows in mud. And so in order for it to grow and bloom beautifully, it has to go through the entire process.
That process, the one that truly allows Commercial Center to thrive again, remains unclear. But for those still invested in its future, the hope is that its cultural, creative, and community benefits will help its history endure. Rafaela Gandolfo Bustamante, KNPR News.
As a note, Lotus of Siam and Derek Stonebarger are financial supporters of Nevada Public Radio. When it rains, it pours. Just ask Las Vegas filmmaker Hussani Mustafa. When we last spoke to Mustafa in 2021, he had just released his full-length feature, Takeout Girl. Since then, he's attended both the College of Southern Nevada and UNLV, grinding away at several short documentary films and PSAs. And over the last 9 months, those works have racked up several awards, including 4 student Emmys. Mustafa just got back from Atlanta, where his latest short film, Gospel for Ghosts, premiered. That short was the result of his work with the Tyler Perry Studios Dream Collective Incubator. He took a break from all of that for a conversation with KNPR's Mike Rivette. Here's that chat.
Hussani, thank you for making time to speak with me today.
I am glad to. Thank you for having me.
Hey, you're welcome. So how did you get involved with a program from such a well-known filmmaker like Tyler Perry?
I actually applied online. It's something called the Tyler Perry Dream Collective. And I just took a big swing and kind of made my way through several rounds of vetting to make a film with them.
And what is that film about?
Gospel for Ghosts. It is a film about a homeless man who's struggling with alcoholism, who breaks into a house thinking he can find something to steal to buy his next drink. But once he's inside, he finds someone that needs him more than he needs that next drink.
Now, besides being accepted into that highly competitive program, you have been winning a lot of awards lately. In the last 9 months, I don't even know if I could count all of them. We mentioned the 4 student Emmys that you've won. You have been in this business for a little more than 2 decades now. You also act, I should add. How does all this recognition feel?
I've been making films since I was 12 years old, so it's even longer than that. The awards feel good. They kind of, I feel like they're like mile markers toward a destination more so than anything else. I think they'll be really cool for my kid to look at one day when he's on his journey toward whatever he wants to do, and he can, you know, draw whatever motivation and whatever sense of confirmation he needs along the way. And also, it's just cool to represent Las Vegas and CSN and UNLV as best I can.
Now, these awards, they include about 4 films per my count. How have you had the time to work on so many projects, or have these projects gone over a long period of time?
They haven't gone over a long period of time. I think I'm a nonstop sort of guy when it comes to that. I really want to succeed as a filmmaker. And there's a piece of me that has always believed that that comes from constant output. I think if I get to a point where I have proper financing and proper resources to make a film, I'll slow down and put more energy into those projects. But until then, I'm going at 100 miles an hour.
One of these short films is a PSA on school and gun violence. It's called Bang Bang. What compelled you to make a film on that topic?
Discovering my voice. I think my voice is grounded in a little bit of social commentary and activism. And it just felt really true to who I am to use an opportunity. I actually got this opportunity through the Commercial Directors Diversity Program. They gave me a little bit of money. They gave me a crew. And they gave me the opportunity to make whatever I wanted. And what popped out to me was this. And it turned out pretty well.
One of the 3 award-winning documentary shorts, it's called Legend Has It, The Remarkable Rise of Stephen McCain. This was made while you were a student at the College of Southern Nevada. How instrumental was CSN's film program in making that project?
Incredibly. CSN is kind of magical in the combination that they have there. We have Keith Strasbaugh, who is the story guy. He makes sure that you have your story tight. You have Aliano, who pushes you to be technically sound and to have a solid work ethic. And Sean Collette as well, who pushes you to be practical about your approach, pushes you to take good care of yourself along the process. And that combination just, man, it brings out the best in you.
You have since transferred to UNLV to study film. How has that film program helped you to level up as a filmmaker?
UNLV, if I had to sum it up in one word, I would say supportive. Mm-hmm. The professors have given me the motivation and the support I needed to feel confident in my choices. I work very closely with Dr. Heather Addison, the program chair, and Professor Brett Levner. She puts her fingerprint on most of the choices I make. And because of that, I feel even more confident when I put my camera on set, you know?
You recently traveled to film festivals like Sundance and Tribeca. Is it hard for an up-and-coming filmmaker to travel to all these festivals and award show while you're also cranking out films at a high clip and you're attending school?
It is. I've made a decision in my life that has paid off in ways I really didn't predict. I got scared as a teenager and joined the military. I was a Marine, and my earnings as a Marine are what they're really paying for my travel. I wouldn't be able to do it any other way. I got to go to Sundance to represent UNLV. Heck of an experience. And I got to go to Tribeca to represent Bang Bang. And I was amongst five or six PSAs, commercials. Coca-Cola was in my category, Instacart, Google. I got to share a nomination with Spike Jonze, the legendary Spike Jonze.
When you were courting votes for the Webby Awards, this is for Bang Bang also, and spoiler alert, you won it, although you won for the jury's award, not the online voting award. Still, you said that winning such an award would be life-changing. Has that bore out yet?
I think it has. I think all of these opportunities, they snowball. And I think the Webbies are a very prestigious thing. And I also, I'm of the mind that the check is in the mail. I'm probably going to get the check for the Webbies 5 or 6 years from now, but I'll still take it when it comes.
What are you working on now?
Right now, I am working on a short film through the Ride Back Rise Fellowship. The Ride Back Rise Fellowship is a writing program at Ryback Studios, which is Dan Lin's studio. He owns a good portion of Netflix, and he uses his resources to foster, you know, and nurture the talent of people of color. And this film I'm making is a kind of coming of age, a story about seeing your parents as people, not just parents. Going to shoot it here in Las Vegas. My first big project to shoot here in Las Vegas. That'll be shooting in July.
And as far as the works that we've been talking about that are winning these awards, is there a place where people can see any of them?
You can see the PSA, Bang Bang, if you go onto Tribeca X's website. You can also see it through the Webbies, where the winner's page is. And those two are good enough. you can see them there.
Hassani Mustafa is an award-winning filmmaker and a current UNLV film student. Hassani, thanks again.
I can't thank you enough.
You're welcome.
In 2002, movie theaters around the country sold an estimated 1.6 billion movie tickets. In 2024, that number dropped to 823 million, a nearly 50% decrease. The biggest culprit? Streaming services like Netflix and Hulu. One local theater is fighting for its audience by fighting back against those streamers. Downtown Las Vegas's independent movie house, the Beverly Theater, has launched a promotion through September 1st called Stream Strike. It offers people who cancel or pause one or more approved streaming services free movie tickets in return. And here's the subplot. AI services like ChatGPT are also included. Here to explain what's going on is Kip Kelly, CXO of the Beverly Theater. Kip, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you come up with this idea of enticing people to cancel their streaming services? Because let me tell you, I've been looking for a reason to get rid of Netflix.
Yeah. Well, actually, it was a personal experience I had in the fall of last year with YouTube TV. They had a little bit of a fight with ESPN and Monday Night Football, and they kind of gaslit me into being on their side in the whole ordeal. And I was, and I stood against ESPN and the man, and YouTube TV. Eventually, they made a deal, and then a couple months later, they raised their prices. And so I said, you know, I've been looking for a reason to kind of get rid of some of my subscriptions anyway. I'll go watch more movies. I run a movie theater. No big deal. I'll watch more movies. And then in that moment, it just kind of hit me. What if everyone else had that access too? What if everyone else kind of had that excuse to take a pause from their streaming subscriptions? And if they're looking for a reason, maybe we can give them one.
Is the Beverly more susceptible to the whole all watch it at home phenomenon than other theaters?
Nah, you know, the funny thing is someone listening to this is probably, you know, and you kind of set it up, but oh, theater operator just grumpy because streaming and they just, it's a ploy to get people to come to the theater. And you're half right. It's not a ploy. We do want you to come to the theater. But the Beverly Theater was built, you know, in 2021, we broke ground. We were very much entrenched in streaming culture at that time. And our program was never really to try to compete with the living room. I always thought that that was a mistake. You know, it's our job to give people a reason to come to the movie theaters. And whether it's some big opening that the studio has that has, you know, something you want to see, or it's a promotion or some other reason for you to come break away from your living room, that's kind of our job. So I don't know that we're more susceptible. I think streaming as a whole is just part of our daily ritual. And, you know, it's happened so quickly and so fast that we probably think there was no other reason or no other way for us to live. And, you know, when it comes to streaming and the rise of AI, I think there was probably 500 other roads we could have taken as a society with those tools. And we probably took the wrong one, if I'm being honest. So I think this is just an opportunity for us to take inventory of what we're paying for and give people a reason to take a break for the summer or forever, whatever you want to do, really.
So what's been the response? You know, how many people have taken advantage of this?
Well, we are about 3.5 weeks in, and we've exchanged almost 2,000 tickets for subscriptions. So Las Vegas has called my bluff. If this was a bluff, they're showing up and they're exchanging their subscriptions for tickets. And, you know, I'm thrilled at that. I think the last 365 days have been really, really good for media barons and for corporate capitalists, and they've been less good for arts education and the opportunity for human achievement with the rise of artificial intelligence. So I'm happy that we're spreading awareness for that. As Vegas's only art house, it's important that we kind of stand both feet firmly planted on the ground for artists and for human achievement and for an opportunity to have more curated human experiences. So if people are showing up and saying, I've got $200 worth of subscriptions that I want to get rid of for the summer, give me 200 tickets, I am happy to do that.
So walk me through this. How does this work? I show you proof of my pause Netflix. You know, that's $20
yeah.
a month. I cancel my Hulu. That's $18, $19 a month. Is that one ticket per cancellation, or is that multiple dollars? How does it work?
It's every dollar that you've spent on subscriptions is matched with movie tickets. So yeah, if you if you're paying $24.99 for Netflix, we're rounding it up to $25. if you pay $19.99 for Hulu, we're rounding it up to $20, and that's 45 tickets that you get. And you just got to come down to the box office, show us proof. They usually send you a cancellation email, and you say, I canceled it. And there's lots of questions. What if I canceled 2 months ago? What if I already had, you know? I didn't spend a whole lot of time writing policies and procedures for this thing. We kind of just said we're going to do it and we'll borrow trouble later, or we're not borrow trouble now. We'll worry about the trouble later when it happens. So yeah, if you got something you canceled before June 1st, okay, just come show it to us. We'll figure it out. You know, we just want you guys to have an opportunity to have some more curated human experiences. And as, you know, purveyors of content ourselves, you know, if we're asking you to cancel something that you got content from, we're happy to, you know, replace that. So, you know, we can offer kind of a one-for-one, not just dollars and subscriptions, but kind of a one-for-one watch something as well.
You know, I want to know the dirt. What is the streamer that's been canceled the most?
Netflix.
Why?
Well, I'll give them some grace in that it's probably also the most subscribed to. So maybe there's just, it's the most popular one that people have. You know, I also think it's the one that gets people riled up when you talk about streaming services and subscriptions, especially when you talk about, you know, all of the chaos created by Netflix and Warner Brothers and Paramount in this past year, and all of it kind of just leading to more and more fees for us. And Netflix has never lowered their monthly price. It's always gone up, and I think it continues to go up. And so when people get an opportunity to cancel something, Netflix is probably, fairly or not, going to be the one that gets the most hate. Yeah.
You know, one of the reasons I think they're, for me at least, talking about canceling subscriptions, It just feels like the content that these streamers are producing is just not quite what it was a few years ago. It's just continuing to slip. I mean, is there a reason for that? Are we seeing more concentration towards putting so much content out that we're actually getting less good quality content?
Oh, for sure. It's quantity over quality. That's the goal of streamers. You know, I always say there's some great stuff to stream. There's some good stuff to stream, and there's a lot of bad stuff to stream. And that ratio continues to get further and further apart. And that's just because, you know, networks for the longest time made 22 episodes because advertisers ran them, and it made sense. And that's that's how the model worked. You wanted to have a full season for advertisers to give you money. And now when you're talking about signups, you need to make more and you need to make less of those things because you want subscriptions. So 10 episodes of something great gets people to sign up, and 10 episodes of something bad, you can dump it quick and it doesn't cost so much.
We got about 30 seconds left. This promotion ends on September 2nd. Do you think you'll have rewired your audience by then, or what happens after that?
I don't know. I don't know if we'll do this again. We'll see. I hope that people enjoyed a break from streaming and some of their AI services and more human experiences. I'll just keep saying that. So I'm hope they're wired a little bit differently by September 1st, sure.
That's Beverly Theater CXO Kip Kelly. Kip, thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
And a note, KNPR receives financial support from the Beverly Theater and UNLV.